Harper Audio presents Negotiating for Dummies, written and read by Michael Donaldson. Actually, I wrote Negotiating for Dummies with my wife, Mimi Donaldson. She is an author, speaker, trainer, and consultant to Fortune 500 companies across the land. I am an entertainment attorney. That means I negotiate all day long. You also negotiate all day long with your boss or your coworkers, your customers and your vendors, at home and at the office, with parents and children and even your spouse. I define negotiating as any communication where you're trying to get a yes, or you're trying to get some action, or you're just trying to get somebody to get out of the way so that you can accomplish something on your own. All negotiations involve six basic elements, whether you are negotiating a $10 million network deal or one of those one-minute life negotiations such as, honey, please put the seat down. In this tape, we're going to go over the six basic elements, just as they are presented in the Negotiating for Dummies book published by IDG. In that book, there are a bunch of little icons over in the left-hand column. In the tape, you will hear a bell like this, which will be the audible icon for tips, write it down, and inside scoop. For the activities, I will just give you the voice cue that there is something fun and relaxing for you to do on your own time to improve your negotiating skills. Sit back and enjoy this tape any way you want, from beginning to end, or little pieces at a time. Keep coming back to it for ways to make your negotiating skills grow and serve you. Now let's get started. Here are the six basic elements of every negotiation. Number one, prepare. And maybe I should call that prepare, prepare, prepare. It is that important. Number two, setting limits and setting goals. We hear a lot about setting goals, but it is setting limits that draws the lines and puts you in charge of the negotiation. Number three, push the pause button. This is the element that helps you maintain your emotional distance, that helps you keep your cool. It is the one thing that every single other negotiating book says you have to do, and they don't tell you how to do it. We do. Number four, listening. And we mean listen with your eyes and with your ears, and with every pore in between. Number five, being clear. That is the flip side of good listening. It is also what a lot of people think of when they first think of negotiating, and yet it is the fifth element of negotiating. It's being clear in what you say, and what you write, and all of your actions during a negotiation. Number six, the final element is the close. It is the separate element that you have to keep in mind during the entire negotiation, not just something that emerges from a successful negotiation. Already negotiating is beginning to sound simple. A negotiation is not some big, awesome event. It is simply using six basic skills to get what you want. Think of this tape like going to a tennis camp. Nobody teaches you how to play all of tennis, all at once. Rather, the game is broken down into elements: the serve, the backhand, the forehand, playing at the net, playing at the baseline. All of these different elements add up to a great game of tennis. The same is true in negotiating. The six basic elements I'm going to be talking about on this tape all add up to world-class negotiating. So let us get started with element number one, prepare. Negotiating is not a skill to take out once in a while when you have to make a deal. Negotiating is a way to get what you want every day of your life. In order to do that, you must also do some long-range thinking about your own life. Often, people are unhappy about the results of a specific negotiation, when the real problem is that they should not be in those negotiations in the first place. So first, create your vision. Most corporations and businesses have a mission or vision statement. If you want to have the best personal life and the most successful career you can have, you need a plan too. Even a little planning is more than most people do, so making a small effort now puts you far ahead of the pack. The first step is to identify your vision. A vision is an image of a desired future. You should state your vision by describing it in the present tense, in a picture of the future you see for yourself. Your vision should be as rich in detail and as visual as possible. The description must be clear, understandable, and descriptive. Most important, your vision needs to motivate you. You count on your vision to give your life shape and direction. Your vision is a long-term, ongoing, open-ended process. Keeping a written record creates better accountability. When you read your vision statement, it motivates you to passionately seek to achieve your goals. And you may want to pick up a copy of the book Negotiating for Dummies for a nifty worksheet that'll help you create your own vision. By answering a few simple questions like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Your own personal vision for your own personal life will emerge. The next step is to make a commitment. Sure, you have an idea of what a commitment is, but do you really know how to make and keep a commitment? In our experience, people want to commit, but they lack the stuff to carry through with that desire. For example, people who say they want to be thin may really want to be thin, but they don't exercise, they keep eating too much, they eat the wrong things. They don't want to be thin badly enough to commit to the steps they need to follow to get thin. The truth is, they wish that they wanted to be thin badly enough to commit to it. You must be so committed to your vision that you will do the hard work necessary to get you where you want to go. To be a successful negotiator at home, you must go through the same process as if you were negotiating in business. Writing visions, values, and goals for your family may not seem as natural as preparing the same statements for your business. But if you aren't specific enough about your vision, you are setting yourself and others up for disappointment and frustration. Next, identify your personal values. Your values are the principles and standards you live by. They define how you regard others and how you expect to behave toward other people. Your vision tells you where you want to go. Values define how you behave as you go there. Values also define your limits, the boundaries of behavior you will not cross. The clearer you are with your values, the more you understand what it is you cherish. Then, making choices about your goals becomes easier. To be a master negotiator, you must be able to look into your own eyes in the mirror every morning and know you are living up to your own standards. Your personal values are the stars to steer your ship by. Okay, having a vision and knowing your own values is great, but you need to know how you're going to get where you want to go. You have to set a path for yourself so that you can eventually live in that picture you have in your head according to the values you have in your heart. We are talking about making a life plan, a 5-year life plan. This is different from setting goals for a specific negotiation. Maybe 5 years from now you won't achieve everything you planned for. But if you don't give any thought to what you want to accomplish over the next 5 years, you don't stand a chance of attaining much of anything. Most people who aren't happy with their lives and what they accomplished during the last 5 or 10 years never bothered to look forward and develop a plan for that time period. Don't let that happen to you. Make a 5-year plan and then make sure your negotiations contribute to achieving that plan. Close your eyes and picture your ideal personal and business life for the next 5 years. Think about ways in which you hope to have helped others, how you would like to have impacted your community, what you and your family want to be doing, what business you will be in, how successful you will be. Imagine how your family will contribute to society and to each other. And when you do, think big. In every aspect of a specific negotiation and in planning your life, think big. You can always scale back later. This is your life. When the next year goes by, it will be gone. You don't get to do it over again. So take off the ball and chain. Don't let your life be shackled by small thoughts. You can never get more out of your life than you choose to. And think bold. In addition to thinking big, you need to think bold. When your vision seems very distant, when the road seems all uphill, you have to be very creative. Try tackling the problem in a different way to reach a solution. The problem of figuring out how to make your vision become a reality is really an opportunity. Finally, think in sound bites. We used to discourage students from using catchwords during life planning. We thought of the life plan was too important, ought to be more tailored, personal. Over the years, we have learned that some phrases act as strong guideposts. They are particularly helpful in getting some complicated concepts across to others in seminars and lectures. We list a few of our favorite sound bites for life planning. We like to offer these phrases after people have established their mission statements and before action plans are designed. Here are three. Number one, escape the tyranny of or. As people make life plans, they often ask themselves whether they want this or that. Try to use the word and. The word or is limiting. The word and is expansive. Frequently, finances require that people choose between two desired purchases. When you make a life plan, however, include everything you want in life. You only get one chance to live this life. Live it free of the tyranny of or. Two, the banishment of just. Whatever you do in life, do it well and with pride. Never again say, I am just a housewife or I am just a salesman. Just, as an adjective to describe one's life work, should be banished from the kingdom. After you have established your vision, never diminish it with a just. Number three, obey the law of parsimony. You have limited time in your life. You can't help everybody. Only help the people who can use your help. Those are not necessarily all the people who need your help. Needy people who would love to distract you from your life purpose pop up all the time. Your job is to keep a steely eye on those goals you want to achieve for yourself and for your family. The next step is to create your action plan. Your action plan includes the specific tasks that you need to do and when you need to do them. Action plans make you more efficient and more effective. They enable you to anticipate needs, potential problems, and the time necessary for each step. The process of creating an action plan brings to light any potential obstacles that you may encounter in achieving your vision. Then you can be clear about what you need to do to overcome those obstacles. Once we have an action plan, we are ready to get ready for a specific negotiation. Remember, the one with the most knowledge wins. Some people think that power comes from size or gruffness or clout, but the easiest and most effective single thing you can do to increase your power in a negotiation is to prepare. You may be facing the greatest negotiator in the world, but if you are prepared and the greatest negotiator isn't, you have the upper hand. You should know about all aspects of negotiation before you begin. Identify the items that are most important for your next negotiation and get to work. The task breaks down into two major categories of preparation. First is the issue under negotiation. When you begin the actual dialogue, make sure that you know more about the subject matter than does the person with whom you are negotiating. And the other thing is the person with whom you are negotiating. Learn as much as possible about your counterpart and what that person wants out of the negotiation. If preparation know-how doesn't come naturally to you, try to make a game of it. If you are entering a negotiation to buy or sell a product or service, pretend that you're solving a mystery, the mystery of value. What is the product or service worth? Forget about the asking price. What is it really worth? Begin with these two important facts. First, value is always in the eye of the beholder. When you finish with your research, only you can conclude the ultimate value of a service or product. You must decide. Second, you can find insider information on the value. From diamonds to dime stores, experts compile price surveys. They put out reports on the information they collect. These publications are how insiders know what's going on in their world. Identify these Bibles of values, which every business has. Get your hands on one and use that information to your advantage. We recommend that you consult consumer reports, browse online services, and visit your local library. These resources can be of great use. Don't forget that values change over time. One important thing for you to decide, if you are a purchaser, is how long you're going to keep the item you are buying. The longer you plan to keep your purchase, the longer it needs to hold its value. As you gather information, be sure to keep good notes. You can't expect to keep all the facts you gather in your head. Even after a negotiation gets underway, you can continue your preparation by asking your counterpart questions. Some people are reluctant to ask questions because they are afraid of appearing dumb. That false pride can be very expensive. Your job is to get a good outcome, not to impress the seller. Keep in mind that the answer you receive during a negotiation may or may not be accurate. Always accept it with respect, and then check it out for yourself. You have an obligation to yourself to be sure that any information you are relying on is indeed reliable. Even experienced negotiators who focus on preparation as a separate step almost always shortchange themselves in one area. They fail to gather enough information about the individual with whom they are negotiating. For instance, if you plan to buy a house, you probably have a checklist of requirements such as maximum down payment, monthly mortgage, things like that. Some realtors even provide a form answering the most common questions about a house. When you finally locate a house that meets all of your specifications, you typically find out about the asking price of the house. You may even ask about past offers or inquire how flexible the price really is. If you're a more sophisticated buyer, you may obtain actual sales prices in the neighborhood for the previous 6 to 12 months. With all this information, you should be ready to make an offer, right? Wrong. You still need to find out about the seller. Find out why the seller is selling. Make a conscious effort to answer these questions. What financial and other pressures is the seller under? How long has the house been on the market? And how does that compare to the average time on the market for houses in the same area? When and for how much did the seller originally buy the house? What changes has the seller made to the house? And were those changes contracted out or performed by the owner? If the seller won't give you this information, Lean against the fence and have a friendly get-to-know-you kind of conversation with the neighbors. They'll tell you. As you prepare for a negotiation, be alert to the fact that everything is not always as it seems. Maybe, besides buying what you have to sell, the buyer wants to establish a relationship with your company. Maybe the buyer wants to know how your business runs in order to enter the field as well. Maybe the buyer wants to teach another supplier a lesson. These ulterior motives are called hidden agendas. Keep your antenna out for hidden agendas. Understand the motives, the hopes, and the needs of the people you are negotiating with. It's ironic but true. You get more of what you want by being more attuned to what the other person wants. Before commencing a negotiation, make a checklist. Even for a simple and straightforward negotiation, writing down the essential facts before you start negotiating is very helpful. Even more important than writing down the information you gather about the subject is making notes each time you find out something about your counterpart. Write it down. Save it. Add to it. This information is golden. Research indicates that the very act of writing something down improves your chances of remembering the information, even if you throw the note away immediately. Writing down information gives you an easy retrieval system. If passion causes the seller to fudge the facts a bit, you don't need to challenge reality. You can merely say, "Let's check our notes." Read the original statements back. That approach is much less insulting than saying, "But you said." The latter frequently starts an argument that no one can win. The former generally settles or avoids an argument altogether. You may want to grab a copy of the book Negotiating for Dummies for the information checklist about the person with whom you plan to negotiate. Never commence negotiations until you are ready, until after you prepare. This is not a rule. It's a fact of life. Neither side should start negotiating prematurely. You can stumble around on an impromptu basis, but you cannot negotiate effectively unless you prepare. Once you are prepared for the negotiation, prepare for the first negotiating session. People often spend very little time considering the best environment for negotiating, and they rely on rules that make arranging a time and place difficult. For example, when both sides consider it necessary to negotiate in their own office, getting things started can be nearly impossible. Your own office often provides a powerful advantage because it is your home turf. You have all the data handy. You have supplemental staff should you need their expertise. It is, after all, your operational base. Your comfort level is going to be at its highest in that environment. Be aware that the rule of negotiating on your home turf is not set in stone. Sometimes meeting in the other party's office is actually better for you. If your opponent in a negotiation always claims to be missing some document back at the office, meeting there could avoid that particular evasion. Sometimes bulky, hard-to-transport documents are critical to a negotiation. In that event, the best site for a negotiation is wherever those documents happen to be. Seating arrangements are the subject of many jokes, and sometimes the importance of seating can be overemphasized, but not often. Definitely do not leave seating to chance. In spite of the number of people who seem willing to do so, here's some seating tips. Sit next to the person with whom you need to consult quickly and privately. Sit opposite the person with whom you have the most conflict. If you want to soften that conflict, you can be off-center by a chair or two. Consider who should be closest to the door and who should be closest to the phone. If you expect to use the phone or to have people huddling outside the negotiating room, these positions can be positions of power. If you are in your boss's office to negotiate something important to you, like a raise, avoid the seat where you normally sit to take instruction. If your boss has a conversation area, try to move there for your discussion. Sofas are the great equalizers. If your boss is firmly planted behind the desk, do two things. Stay standing for a while so that you are meeting at eye level. When sitting, move your chair to the side of the desk, or at least out of its regular position. You want to make the statement that this is a different conversation than the normal routine of your boss assigning you a task. When deciding where to negotiate, be sure that both sides can listen to everything that's said. Many times, people choose a lunch meeting to discuss important matters. Meals are generally not a good time to negotiate anything of any importance. First, many a trendy restaurant is noisy. Second, restaurants are rife with uncontrollable inquiries concerning your desires or the quality of service, and aggravating questions about water replenishment. Agendas for a negotiating session are a wonderful control device. An agenda makes it more difficult for the other side to avoid addressing an uncomfortable issue. Creating an agenda is an advantage to you, even if you are not in charge of the meeting. If you don't want to or aren't ready to discuss a certain topic, leave it off the agenda. Alternatively, you can include a related topic. The written word has real power in our society. A written agenda in front of all the participants in a meeting has a power and authority all its own. The plan also brings some clarity to a meeting. By providing what amounts to an outline for the meeting, a written agenda inspires people to take notes on what is happening. An agenda suggests the order in which issues will be discussed, but does not dictate the order. If controversy arises on a particular point, an agenda makes it easy to move past the point and come back to the dispute later. Don't be upset if someone else reorganizes your perfect order, especially if you are not in charge of the meeting. The amount of time to allocate for a negotiating session or for the entire negotiation is always a tricky matter because you are not in control of the other side. If you want to have the negotiation over by a certain time, say so right up front. If a good reason exists for your desire, state that also. Leaving more time than you actually need for a negotiating session is always better than allocating too little time. And remember, you are the most important single element in this negotiation. Even if you are the assistant to the assistant to the assistant, your performance at the negotiation is more important to you and to your future than any room or agenda or seating arrangement. To negotiate at your best, you must be well-rested and alert because you're more likely to be quick-witted and able to respond to questions or attacks. Your concentration and ability to listen are improved. And you won't be rushing to tie things up so that you can get home or get to bed. As you prepare yourself for your first negotiating session, we can give you no better overall advice than to mirror your environment. Sink into the surroundings. Some negotiators even adapt to the pace of the speech. In New York, where people tend to talk fast, good negotiators speed up their pace a bit. And in the South, where people tend to talk slowly, good negotiators slow it down a few notches. Above all, know that good manners are different from place to place. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. No matter how sleep-deprived or harried or down in the dumps you may be, always enter the negotiating room perky and assertive. Establish confidence and control from the opening moment. That moment sets a tone for the entire meeting. This fact is true even if you are not officially in charge of the meeting. These guidelines can vault the most junior person at a meeting to most valuable player status almost immediately. Never forget the pleasantries. If the last negotiating session ended on a bad note, clear that away first. Otherwise, you run the risk that unrelated matters may ignite the controversy all over again. If you can resolve the situation up front, you can move forward unfettered. Now let's move on to the second basic element, set limits. Your limits define what you are willing to give up in order to get what you want. Setting limits means establishing the point at which you're willing to walk away from the negotiation and pursue some alternative course. Your limit may be the highest price you'll pay for a car, or the lowest salary you'll accept from a prospective employer. It's the farthest you're willing to drive before it's your spouse's turn to take over, or the latest curfew you'll allow for your teenager. If your limits are crossed, no car, no job, no trip, no date, no dice. When you know how to set limits and have confidence in that ability, the entire negotiating process changes. You can hang tough or walk away from a negotiation when necessary. You can set limits in four easy steps. Well, four steps. Step one, know that you have other choices. Texas billionaire Nelson Bunker Hunt is often quoted as saying, "There is always another deal around the corner." One reason Bunker made so many good deals during his life is that he was always willing to walk away from a deal if it was not right. He was good at setting his limits and then sticking to them. Bunker's slogan must be part of your core beliefs. Keep repeating his quote until it becomes a part of your belief system. There is always another deal around the corner. There is always another deal around the corner. Step two, know what those other choices are. We urge you not only to develop your best alternative if this particular negotiation does not work out, but the second best and the third best. List all the alternatives available to you should the negotiation fail to close on the terms you want. Don't edit your list. Make it as long as possible. Life is always about exercising options. Step three, know your or else. Once you have created the list of alternatives, that is, once you have set out all your choices, decide which alternative is most acceptable to you. Pick your personal or else. Decide now what it is you want to do if the negotiation doesn't close. Think about that course of action. Play the scenario out in your mind. Be sure you can live with your or else. If you are like most of us, you could use some in practice with enforcing your limits. So, step four, practice enforcing your limits. Start in a less charged situation outside of your personal or business relationship, like one of those overpriced souvenir shops on vacation. Set your limit and walk away if the shopkeeper won't match it. This kind of practice in enforcing your limits will help you in more important areas of your life. Limits are not much help if you cave in every time you set them. In fact, caving in too often can gravely affect a relationship. Parents who constantly lay down the law, only to pick it up a few minutes later, usually end up raising brats, and confused, unhappy brats at that. One reason you must be very certain to set limits is that the limits that you set automatically define your resistance point. Your resistance point is close to your limit, but leaves enough room to close the deal without crossing your limit. At the resistance point, you let the other party know that they are getting close to your limit, that you will soon be walking away. If you state your limits immediately when negotiations commence, you violate a fundamental tenet of good negotiating. That is, never, ever paint yourself into a corner. In negotiations, you paint yourself into a corner by taking a strong stand and not leaving yourself an alternative or an out. Setting limits is tough. Walking away is even tougher. You may actually be afraid that something bad is going to happen if you walk away from a negotiation. Walking away often feels like failure. Don't worry. Nothing terrible will occur if you walk away. In fact, sometimes the best deal in town is no deal at all. After you set your limits, you are ready to set your goals. Setting goals for yourself, for others, or for your organization is a practical activity that demands preparation and a disciplined focus. Setting goals is not wishful thinking. It is not fantasizing. A goal is an end that you strive to obtain. Research shows that individuals who set challenging, specific goals do better than those who do not. Be sure that everyone who is a member of the negotiating team participates, to the extent possible, in setting the goals. Some people may not be verbal, but make sure that they are on board, even in a passive way. You need everyone to agree on the goals. Then they are more likely to own the goals and to go that extra mile to get the results. Don't have too many goals. The negotiation itself dictates the number of specific goals you should set. It's amazing how many goals some people can squeeze into even a simple negotiation. Recognize that you cannot get everything done in one negotiation. For example, if your priority is to get a raise, don't demand flex time and an assistant as well. By putting too much on the table at one time, you just confuse people. Eyes will glaze over and you may not get anything at all. Be sure to weigh your goals in terms of importance. It is a rare negotiation in which you achieve all of your goals. You must know which are the most important. This decision can become contentious. Teams often abandon the critical step of making priorities in the name of keeping the peace within the negotiating team. Unfortunately, such teams are only deferring the argument to a later point, and probably a worse time. Now you are ready to think about the opening offer. The opening offer is nothing more and nothing less than the first specific statement of what you are looking for in a negotiation. After you set your goals for the negotiation, you can consider the opening offer. To determine your opening offer, you should draw heavily on the goals and limits you set and the information you have gathered while preparing for the negotiation. Have your opening offer in mind, even if you don't plan to state it openly. This approach speeds your reaction time to whatever offer the other side makes. And now let's look at the skill that all master negotiators possess. It's the skill that intimidates, inspires awe, or just plain leaves others in the dust. This essential negotiating skill is the ability to maintain emotional distance from whatever is being discussed. We call it pushing the pause button. This just means putting the negotiations on hold for a moment, or an hour, or an evening, while you sort things out. Everyone owns a pause button, so to speak, and everyone pushes it in a different way. Sometimes how you push the pause button depends on the situation. Ask for a night to think the negotiation over. Most people will respect your request to sleep on it. Excuse yourself to the restroom. Who's going to refuse that request? For a short break, just lean back in your chair and say, "Wait a minute, I have to take that in." In a business situation, you can have someone with whom you have to consult before giving a final answer. Simply say, "I'll have to run this by my partner," and get back to you in the morning. Your first practical opportunity to use the pause button arrives before you participate in the first session of a negotiation. Ask yourself whether you are as prepared as you need to be. Then, When the first sentence is uttered, you're ready to listen because you have pushed the pause button. When you speak your first words, you are more clear for having taken that little break. Some negotiators use pressure to get what they want from you. Sometimes the pause button is your only defense against being pressured into making a decision based on somebody else's deadline. Your awareness of the pause button sets you apart from other negotiators. But don't worry if the other side is also aware of this technique. Don't think of the pause button as a top secret weapon, because when your negotiating counterpart has his own pause button, the negotiations proceed even more smoothly and come to a more satisfactory resolution. Allowing the other party to push the pause button, or pushing your own pause button, makes the negotiating process more focused, more effective, and more pleasant for everybody. When you are negotiating about something to which you have an emotional attachment, you must be sure that you have the pause button well in hand. Use it every step of the way so that your emotional side doesn't trigger a decision before it's time. Be sure to check the limits you set before sitting down at the negotiating table so that you don't make a bad deal because of emotional stress. This kind of stress is particularly high around hot topics such as divorce or illness or natural disasters like fire, earthquakes, and such. To negotiate masterfully, you must stay in control of your emotions. Negotiations naturally involve a risk of being upset. When people don't get what they want, one natural response is to get angry. Everyone knows what it feels like. The pressure literally builds inside your body. You feel like exploding, and sometimes you do. However, you have the ability to express anger calmly but firmly. Here's what you do. Use I statements. For example, say, "I feel really angry because." Avoid you statements, such as, "You are wrong because." The word you is accusatory, and it escalates the emotional charge in the situation. Some meetings get pretty emotional for everyone. However, if you don't keep your emotions in check by curbing inflammatory behavior, you won't get anything accomplished. Four types of people can throw your meeting off course unless you stay in control. They are the dominators, the ramblers, the competing conversers, and the arguers. The dominators are people who disrupt your negotiation because they need to dominate the conversation. You need to credit the speaker's knowledge of the subject, then ask another individual for their views or reactions. The ramblers are people who go off on tangents and bore the other participants. Usually, these folks just need attention. You need to confirm your understanding of the point of the story, restate the urgency of the objectives and the time constraints, then direct a question to another participant to refocus on the objectives. The competing conversers, who have side conversations while you are trying to make progress on the meeting, create several problems. You lose the attention of those people. You also lose control of the meeting. Side conversations tend to multiply. You need to pause and look directly at the conversers. Ask the conversers to share their ideas with a group, restate the importance of the objectives, and state that the group will accomplish more if one person speaks at a time. Arguers feel a need to argue with whatever is being discussed. It doesn't matter what subject is being discussed. Up go their hands, and out comes a slightly contrary view of the matter. Address the person who is presenting the argument. Use paraphrasing to express your understanding of the remarks he or she has made. If more than one person is involved, do this for each person. Then restate the agreed-upon agenda in order to move the discussion back towards your desired outcome. Summarize points of agreement to reestablish a positive tone. Negotiating within the context of a valued, ongoing relationship is different from a one-time agreement in three significant ways. Number one, you know this person. You know this person's hot buttons, so you know how to punch below the belt. Number two, you can't walk away. This isn't like buying a used car. If you don't get what you want, you can't just walk down the street and find someone else. Number three, you have baggage, life baggage. If your spouse or longtime coworker or boss turns a phrase that reminds you of one of your parents, all of a sudden you two can end up in a shouting match over a bit of nonsense. You're no longer reacting to the other person. You're reacting to a memory from your childhood that was triggered by some word or posture or tone. Learn to know the difference. And now the fourth skill, active listening. Listening is more difficult than most people realize. Listening appears to be passive, but it is actually an active sport. At its simplest, listening is accurately taking in all that the other party is communicating. Active listening involves all the senses and many screening devices. At its most sophisticated, it is getting the other party to open up, to communicate more information, and to express ideas more clearly than is the norm for that person. You may find that the other person opens up merely because they realize that someone is truly listening. Our experience is that people who interrupt a great deal are generally not very good listeners. Being interrupted tends to bother good listeners more than it bothers people who are not good listeners. Does it bother you if someone interrupts you? If the answer is no, there's a pretty good chance that you need to work on listening skills.